Hello and welcome to The Bagel Bite with me, Hayden Cohen. Apologies, it's been a bit of a while, life etc. But to make up for it, in celebration of LGBT Plus Month, I have three stories for you over the next few weeks. Now I know for a lot of people, there are complex emotions and thoughts wrapped up in all of this. However, I'd ask you to listen to three very different stories coming from three very different places, and just listen. Coming up, we have an Orthodox rabbi who advocates for trans rights, as well as someone who defines as non-binary. But for today, I have Executive Director of Keshet UK, Dahlia Fleming. She really is a fantastic advocate for the rights of the LGBT plus community within our own Jewish community. She was positively bursting to tell her story, so you join us here already in the flow of the conversation about the term LGBT.
So when it comes to the acronym, I don't personally think that there's any form of right acronym. You know, way back historically, it was LG, just lesbian and gay. Eventually, bisexuality was included in that, and then also trans community, so LGBT. And then some communities will use LGBT plus, and that plus can kind of try to acknowledge lots of other identities, such as queer or questioning or asexual or intersex or pansexual or whatever identities that particular community is trying to include. I think for me, the important thing is not to be tokenistic with that, whilst acknowledging that LGBT is the kind of more known acronym, but other people will use LGBTQ, LGBTQI, LGBTQIA. It really depends on the community and what the person is trying to say as to which acronym they may use.
Right. I felt like we actually jumped in there. Just because it was an interesting conversation, just jumped in and thought I'd hit record, right? So I'm joined by Dahlia Fleming, who is the Executive Director of Keshet UK, which is an LGBT plus organisation for the British Jewish community. Got that right?
Yep, that is right. We're a charity with the vision that to create a world where no one has to choose between their Jewish and LGBT plus identity.
And how are you doing with that?
We're doing all right. So we work with all denominations. We work with Orthodox, Liberal, Masorti, Reform, cross-communal, non-denominational, in kind of four main areas. We work with schools, youth and young adult organisations, synagogues, and wider communal organisations. So we aren't trying to recreate anything. What we're trying to do is make sure that our community, the community we've grown up in, the community that we love, is inclusive. So that if you're going to work with Jamie or Jewish Care or any school or any youth group, as an LGBT plus Jewish person, you can walk into that space and you can know what to expect, you can feel safe, and that organisation is doing the work so that you can enter it safely.
It's actually a really interesting question, right? So in terms of, is traditional Jewish thought inclusive?
I mean, that is a big question. And I think it really depends on who you're trying to include and how you think about inclusion. I think when we go back, and the other thing I should say is that we don't really talk on like halacha at Keshet UK. There are lots of values that we use regularly. We are very Jewishly value-based in terms of B'tzelem Elohim and lots of other values that we can use. But in terms of halacha, we don't. However,
Why?
Because actually, people get really stuck on halacha, and what we are trying to do is make them think about what can we do and what are Jewish values that make this important. Because obviously, halacha, for some Jewish communities, is essential. It is the core. It is the thing that guides them. For others, less so. And we want to try and work in a way that can actually work across the community and in different ways, right? So we recently released a guide with Chief Rabbi Mervis, and it was on the well-being of LGBT plus people in Orthodox Jewish schools. And he talks about halacha. If you look at that guide, there is halacha in there, and he is the expert on that, right? I am not an expert on halacha, and so I don't want to get into a space where actually I'm having a conversation with someone in which I might get it wrong. I may not be coming from their same perspective. And it also becomes something that people can so focus on in some ways and have historically with LGBT plus people. You focus on one part of the halakha, which says there are these prohibitions. There are these prohibitions that affect everyone. And then you overlook the other halakha, or what we do is we try to focus in on the values that say that these are the other obligations that we have. And that's actually what I think the chief rabbi is doing in the guide. He says, this is the halakha. I am not questioning that. The halakha is halakha. There are these prohibitions. However, there's other parts of halakha that we have overlooked. And by overlooking it, the obligation to save a life.
Right. No one's kicked the kid out over wearing mixed linens, right?
Right. And by overlooking the other obligations as Jewish people we have, is what, you know what he's saying? We have caused harm. And we've caused unnecessary harm. And I think that's what's so incredible in the guide in terms of how he has thought about halakha in order to allow him to act.
Can you expand upon that process? Because getting the Orthodox Chief Rabbi of the UK to work with an LGBT plus charity is kind of a big deal. It's not kind of, it is like it's a huge deal, right? You know, is there anything in the world to compare it with? And, you know, was that a model that you used? And was there wranglings that happened behind the scenes you might not want to go into? But if you can, I think that'd be really interesting. Yeah. And that process of, like, how long did it take? What concessions did you have to, like, to have that balancing act, especially when, you know, the chief rabbi has, he gets it from both sides, right? You know, so like the world of the Haredim think that is a bit too liberal. He has a delicate balancing act. So I'm just curious, how did you navigate that at Keshet?
So I think it's interesting you use the word kind of wrangling. And I genuinely actually wouldn't say there was any. So we've been kind of a bunch of people in the community doing work in the community for about 6-ish years. We were literally just volunteers going, no one is doing any form of this education work. Keshi K actually started because there was an incident in an Orthodox Jewish school where they spoke about so-called conversion therapy. And that's a kind of therapy, and I say so-called because it's not actually therapy, where they tell you that they can change you. You go into it with the intention of becoming a cisgendered, so someone who's, your gender is the same as the sex assigned at birth, or straight, and they tell you they can change you into that. And it's dangerous. Like, it's not just something that is not recommended. Every medical body in this country has said how dangerous and harmful it is, and it is a very harmful process. And it was mentioned in an Orthodox Jewish school on a PowerPoint slide in which some of the teachers kind of overlooked the slide. Some of them spoke about it, and none of them spoke about it negatively. And what that told us as a bunch of kind of alumni of that school and LGBT plus Jewish people is there was no one doing any form of education and advocacy work. No one was saying why that was bad. And so even though sometimes actually, you know, if you've got someone who you really look up to and they're saying, well, there's a professional right over there and they can help you. You've had all this judgment from your community. You have this worry about what your life might be like, and they say they can help you. It's coming from a good place. I'm sure some people are doing it from a horrifically malicious place, but I think a lot of people are doing it from a good place of trying to help, not understanding how dangerous it is. So that's kind of how Keshet UK came about. And it's only since about 2014-15 we became a charity and we started formalizing that we've had kind of more full-time support that we've been able to kind of give schools and youth and young adult organizations and kind of the rest of the community. But we started these conversations a long time ago. Some of those conversations were happening in closed doors, you know, it'd be 2 p.m, the curtain's down, and it's because someone is so afraid to have that conversation. For me, there's kind of this axis about why people do things and don't do things in our community, and it's across all denominations. For people to think that this is only an issue, kind of, as you know, in more traditional, observant, orthodox communities, that they would be wrong. There's this kind of axis of like complacency or fear. And the fear that I think it has been in parts of the Orthodox community is, well, if I say something, is someone else going to judge me? I don't know what my community's at because we've never had these conversations. And so Keshet UK have been having these conversations initially very confidentially, very privately. And then actually at the beginning of this year, I had a conversation with a rabbi. I had just started in the job. And I said, oh, this conversation can be confidential if you want. And he said, he was an Orthodox rabbi, if we cannot even say that we are talking, the problem is bigger than I thought it was. And I think that's the thing with this guide. So it came about because we had been working with schools, Orthodox, cross-communal schools, reform, progressive kind of schools. And it became really clear they needed something written down. We started having conversations and it became really clear it needed to be an Orthodox guide. Because actually, there are already guides in which non-Orthodox schools can access and use. And if it wasn't set in an Orthodox theology and an Orthodox understanding, Orthodox schools weren't going to access it and use it. So we started working with Orthodox educators and leaders and trying to co-produce this thing. Because we know that if a guide comes out from Keshet UK to the Orthodox community and the Orthodox community haven't had any say in it, it's not going to do anything. And I don't want something that has our name on it but does nothing, because that's not actually going to make any impact. It might show that we've done something, like, you know, we've created something shiny, but I'm not about shiny. And so we started doing this guide, and the office of the chief rabbi was aware of it. We would meet with him in his office every few months, kind of over the last while. And he then held a meeting in his house with the head teachers of his schools and the heads of Jewish studies, and they said, Keshet UK is doing this guide and you have to be involved in it. We need your involvement, because without that, it'll be harder for us to use it. And we have young people in our schools who we need to protect their well-being, and we need to understand how we can do this from a halachic point of view. And I think also he really felt this personal obligation, I think. I'm not speaking on his behalf, but I feel like when you read his introduction, you feel that. You feel that he understands that harm has been caused, not intentionally, but it's happened. And so actually we then sat down. We sat down, Keshet UK and the office of the chief rabbi and the chief rabbi, and spoke about, what do we want to happen here? We want to protect the well-being of our young people. We want to make sure our schools are safer. And what that allowed us to do is hold on to a shared objective. We are different organisations. We are coming from fundamentally different places. I'm not saying that, you know, suddenly we aligned on everything. We don't. But we do align on is that outcome. So then that meant when we sat down, we were able to say, well, okay, this is what we're trying to say. Is that sentence, is that word going to be harmful to Jewish LGBT plus people? Is that word going to resonate with the Orthodox community? Yes or no? Okay, fine. If it doesn't, what's our outcome? Great. What are we trying to say? What word can we find that will do that? And that's how that process happened. And that's how it went. We sat down and we worked together, understanding that what the point of this is to say that homophobic, biphobic, transphobic bullying is unacceptable, and that all of our young people should feel safe and protected in our schools. And with that as a shared goal, we were able to achieve the guide. And you asked if there's anything else. I did not realize at the time, but there is nothing else like it in the world. There is no one of the standing and the halachic understanding and the kind of the leadership role that the chief rabbi has to put their name to something and say something like he has said, which I think has taken a lot of courage, because to write something down, kind of the difference between, like, you know, written Torah and oral Torah, to write something down has that permanence. But it also allows conversation to start that had not happened. And so it has been broader than schools. It's been happening in synagogues and organisations and homes. And that has been something that's been really magical.
I kind of want to unpick the idea of bullying, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So in terms of, you know, I've been in situations where I've heard certain members of the community say some things which I personally find outrageous, but they don't. Right? They don't acknowledge that what they're saying is bad and might make someone from an LGBT plus background feel victimized. How do you begin to tackle the opinions from those people who don't even think that what they think are opinions? It doesn't come from a position where they feel that they're bullying.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a few different things. I think it depends on your relationship with that person as to kind of where you start, right? Because for some people, when you start saying statistics that over half or nearly half of LGBT plus pupils are bullied in our schools, like nearly one in two.
Out of interest, does that say, are they bullied because they're LGBT plus, or that's why they're bullied?
Yeah.
Okay.
But then, you know, you have those stats, and then you have the stats that say that 2 in 5 trans young people have attempted to take their own life, and just over 1 in 5 lesbian, gay and bisexuals have done the same. When you start looking at those statistics, you need to start thinking that there is a problem. And those statistics are for general society. There aren't stats for kind of Jewish community specifically. But the evidence is out there that something is happening, that because of the way society talks about and talks to LGBT young people, tells them they're not right, tells them they're abnormal, questions who they are, is creating a higher rate of poor mental health. Those statistics are higher than cisgendered straight people. So being LGBT plus is not a mental health condition. But obviously when society is telling you these negative messages, you will have poorer mental health. So if you try and make that understanding, when you try and really explain that opinion is causing that harm, that might be one way to have that conversation. The other way is making it is more general. So when I start a talk, I say, hey, everyone. And I do that because I want to try and be as inclusive as possible. By saying things like, hey, ladies and gentlemen, I might be excluding some people. But if I start something and say, hi, everyone, or hello, distinguished guests, people don't go, oh, Dahlia, being so politically correct today, right? They've not even thought. That's not even clicked. But for those people who don't feel that they are included when you say ladies and gentlemen, they feel more included when you say everybody or distinguished guests or whatever else. And it's about thinking through what can you do? And that's the other thing that I haven't said so far. So we work on this idea that every part of our community can do a bit more. If you're an intolerant community, you can become tolerant. If you're tolerant, you can become accepting. If you're accepting, you become welcoming. And if you're welcoming, you can become celebratory. And if you're celebratory, look at the rest of your community. Look at your leadership. Look at everyone around you and make sure you've taken everyone on that journey. Because actually, if you're celebratory, if your leadership is celebratory, but the rest of your congregation, the rest of your school is kind of tolerant. It's kind of like, we don't really talk about this. We don't really want to talk about this. We don't actually think we should say anything if we see biphobic bullying. There's more work to be done. And so taking people from intolerance to tolerance, that's reducing harm. And if that's where you can get to safely as an organization, that for now is good enough. We don't go in as Kesha UK and say, why did you say this 3 years ago? And why aren't you doing this? And why aren't you doing that? Because actually,
it doesn't matter, right?
It doesn't matter. The communities need to be moving. They need to be thinking that there is something they can do. And they're the ones framing what that is.
I just think that that idea of celebratory, right, is quite... That's very different, very, very different to tolerance and understanding the harm of language. And so even, do you think there will be a point at which that would ever happen in the majority of organisations? As I said, celebratory is quite a big thing, as opposed to saying we acknowledge this as a problem and we need to treat people like human beings, which is an abyss between the two.
Yeah, and there is a big difference. And actually, I would say that in some ways, a tolerant community is not much better than an intolerant community. You know, an intolerant community, well, there will be this really active, open discrimination happening. And actually, in a tolerant community, it's still happening. There's just sometimes a bit more silence about it. It's not really as, it's still not clear whether that's really bad. And there's this, I think, a misunderstanding of the word tolerant. But it is, it's getting to the point of being kind of...
It's a horrible word, isn't it?
Yeah, to be tolerated. I don't think anyone wants to be tolerated. You might want to be accepted or welcomed. And, you know, celebrated is one. I think there may be some communities who don't ever get to how we might define celebratory. But actually, they might get to a place where it is good enough for the Jewish LGBT plus people in their communities. And I also think there's a power in them acknowledging what their limits are. And being honest as that, as a Jewish LGBT plus person, I don't want to walk into a space and be harassed or discriminated against or even disrespectful, right? If I'm walking into a space, whenever I go to a wedding, I ask them, can I wear a suit? Or do I have to try and do something else? Because I'm not a man, right? I'm not a trans man. For people who can't see me, my expression is more masculine. It's where I feel very settled. It's where I feel most myself. I don't always feel cisgendered. I feel a bit kind of queer in my gender. But for me, if I need to, I can put a skirt on. It's not a life or death thing, which it can be for some LGBT plus people. But I don't want to walk into a space. And yet, I still get regularly misgendered at weddings. I've been physically assaulted at weddings. I have been told to leave toilets at weddings because of how I look and what my expression is. And I don't want to be in those spaces and actively putting myself in harm. And I don't think other LGBT plus people, Jewish people, want to be doing that either. And so organizations even knowing what those limits are and then kindly being able to tell people, to me, that is a good step. Because at that point, they're being honest. They're being considerate and they are being kind. They're saying, this is how we can include you and this is where you can be. And these are what our limits are. And actually, if this is what you're looking for, this may not be the space. And that's a hard conversation, but also it's a true one. Jewish LGBT plus people exist in every part of our community. And I want for those people, their home to stay their home. I personally don't want Orthodox Jewish LGBT plus people to leave their community. I don't want liberal Jewish LGBT plus people to be leaving their communities. And actually, it's interesting, like I use liberal as an example because one individual, even though the liberal organization has been at the forefront of fighting for LGBT plus rights in this country in general, if there's one person in there who still is a bit homophobic or biphobic or transphobic, like everyone in society can be, they still might then equate that to their Jewish identity, which is why it's really important for every part of our community to be thinking and being active and not assuming that, oh, I'm part of this progressive community. Oh, our rabbi is a gay person or a bi person, trans person. Therefore, it's obvious we are inclusive. Because from my experience, that just isn't the case and you need to be more proactive.
Why do you think LGBT issues, LGBT plus issues, are such a focus compared to everything else?
I'm not sure if it is above everything else. I think there are some things that we haven't really addressed, right? We haven't addressed Jews of color in our communities and like the racism that they experience, right? We haven't expressed or discussed in some parts of the community where they should be kind of Sephardi Mizrahi Jews and how we need to try and include them more. So I think there are some things that have just been currently ignored and will become more. But I also think I was just in a session.
And by the way, they won't be on this podcast. One of the things, no, and I'm being serious. Yeah, like no, what, good, one of, good. One of, so, you know, I have actually interviewed a Jew of colour who is also from the LGBT plus community.
Oh, wow.
So I'm on it, right?
Yeah.
And
thank you.
Yeah.
And those intersections, right? What is it like to be a Jewish LGBT plus person of colour in these spaces where people already assume that actually you may not even be Jewish, right? Why are you even in this space, right? Because you aren't being perceived as being a white person I'm doing this in quotation marks, all Jews are white, right? So I'm glad that this podcast will be more inclusive, but I think as a community, you know, we have a lot more work to do. I think one of the reasons that it is becoming such a focal point is there's a few. One, wider society in the UK is becoming more accepting. There are more role models. People can feel more confident about coming out and finding a place where they can feel safe. I say that the highest percentage of young people living on the streets are still LGBT plus people, and they are still being disowned to a very high level when they come out. So this is not a rosy picture everywhere, but there is more people coming out. So actually, there are people coming out in all parts of our community, whether it be being bi or trans or queer or asexual, and communities are having to address that, both in terms of the kind of bureaucratic stuff that happens everywhere, which is, this is what my form is, you know, in terms of this is how my, what the accommodation is going to look like. But then also, you know, in terms of rituals and practices, people are having to address it because these people are turning up on their doorsteps in much larger numbers than they have previously. And I also think, I was just in this session at Le Mode about from Orthodox LGBT plus people. There was a panel of Orthodox LGBT plus people, and there was this kind of theme about the policing that goes on within our spaces that is more human than godly, in their opinion. And I think that really does happen. We hold on to this halakha and ignore the other halakha, which then means we've really held on to so much stuff about sex. And honestly, at Kesha UK, I have never spoken about sex or sexual acts in any of our sessions because it's completely irrelevant to the day-to-day lived experience of LGBT plus Jewish people. What's more relevant is, how am I being addressed? How am I being respected? Where can I sit? What will happen if I hold my partner's hand? Can I walk into a space not holding my partner's hand, and will that be okay? And but yet, as humans, we really focus in on something that has meant that we have caused a great amount of harm. And I think it is, you know, sometimes a bit of an obsession with kind of a lot of religious organizations and religious religions to focus in on it, which then makes this issue higher up. Because when you have so much pain and harm being caused quite explicitly, you end up having kind of people trying to work out, well, actually, how can we reduce that? How can we make people safer? How can we make them happier? How can we make them included and welcomed and eventually celebrated?
I'd like to talk a bit about your story, if that's okay.
Go for it.
What's your story?
What's my story? I was brought up Orthodox. I have my mum was brought up kind of at the East End, the council estates of London, literally the butcher, the baker, kind of everything around family, all living in kind of like, you know, a very short period of time. My dad's actually a Holocaust survivor. So he fled from Europe, then lived in Australia, and then lived in Israel for a very long time and was in the Air Force. So his identity is very much like, I'm Israeli, I lived through the Holocaust, like I don't have to do anything, like I'm real Jewish. Like there are these lived experiences have made me the Jew I am today. So he is completely unobservant in every way. The assassination in Israel is the only time he's ever been to synagogue in my lifetime, and my brother's bar mitzvah. But my mum was brought up, that's why I was brought up more observant, but in this household where there was like clashing identities and clashing kind of ways to relate to Judaism. I then went to an Orthodox Jewish secondary school, and it was when I was like pretty young, I started to think about my place as a woman in Judaism and in my communities, and also began to realize that I wasn't straight. And that's like the label I used for myself, not straight, because I knew I didn't really like guys, but I wasn't really sure how I felt, and I didn't really know, and I wasn't really sure. So I was like, I just think I'm not straight. I don't really know what that means. Maybe I do like guys, maybe I don't, but there's something that doesn't feel like I'm experiencing the same things that other people are experiencing. And I think because when I started really questioning my place as a woman in Jewish communities and how I felt, like I didn't really understand where my value was and what my role should be, and how I love praying, and I felt so regularly in my community that I would be there and I could have been doing the hokey cokey and no one would have minded. And I wasn't sure how to do this, but I didn't reject my Judaism. And I think actually because of that lack of rejection then, when I came out as not straight, I also didn't suddenly have the tension that so many Jewish LGBT plus people have, which is these identities are not compatible. They cannot be held in the same space. And so I didn't tear myself apart, because actually the Kesha UK mission statement is, a vision of a world where no one has to choose between their Jewish and LGBT plus identity. And the word choice, even as the executive director, I regularly think, is this the right wording? Because it's not a choice. If you have to decide between two intrinsic identities, you are tearing yourself apart and you are walking through the world in a broken way. And I think I do feel very lucky that I think because of that's how I'd kind of processed one part of it, I didn't do that. I felt there must be somewhere else. There must be something else for me. So I just continued to have very good discussions and debates with rabbis at school and work things out. And I came out at school when I was 14, 15. And that was an interesting experience. I had the Jewish studies lesson where I was told it was an abomination that I should marry a man. I saw some of my friends agree with the teacher. I saw some of my friends stand up for me. I saw some of my friends be silent. And what's funny is in years, more recent times, that lesson has come up in conversation, and some of my friends don't even remember it happened. And for me, it was such an essential moment because I was 14 and having to defend me in a school environment. And that was challenging. But actually, I was never really bullied at school for being LGBT plus. I was bullied for being like really keen. I was like that kid who like always put my hand up. And that was like actually why at school I was relatively miserable for quite a bit of it.
Oh, so was I, you know.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's, you know, enthusiasm is not a proud identity at school. But I feel like it's done me good now. So I'm all right with that. But it was challenging. And then I ended up coming out to my mum when I was 17. I ended up having...
So you said it in school at 14.
Yeah.
And to your mum at 17.
Yeah.
So that never got... I want to ask the question.
Yeah, go for it.
Do you think she actually knew?
I think my mum actually did have some ideas. I don't think my dad did, and we can talk about that. But I think my mum knew. I'd kind of mentioned a few things. I was only out to a few friends at 14, and then I was out quite publicly at school about 16, kind of GCSE, but a few friends kind of knew at 14. I didn't kind of really hide it from 16. If someone asked me, I was like, I'm not straight. It was actually going on Israel tour that kind of, I was like, I want to go into that space and I want to be able to be honest. I don't want to have to lie or divert questions. I don't want to create these new friendships I'm going to get on this amazing experience and lie. So it was around then that I made that really active decision.
And also people hook up on Israel tour.
I mean, I heard that, but like I did not. So that was not my lived experience. But it wasn't about that. That's the thing, right? Like even going back to Keshi K, we don't talk about sex. Like for me, it really wasn't about like even having those relationships. It was about being honest in conversation. Right. When people are talking about who they find attractive or what that, you know, it was that base level that I just didn't want to lie anymore or avoid or divert questions. I was pretty sad and like I would spend a lot of time on my own, but I wasn't lying to them about things. I was just like a vaguely miserable kid, but I really didn't enjoy that lying. It really grated on me. And then, you know, my mum knew who my girlfriend was. She didn't know she was my girlfriend. And so I felt like I was just lying to her. And so I ended up coming out to her and I said, Mum, you know, I nearly came out to her in a car. And the thing I would say is like, when you're ready to come out, you should do it in the way that feels safe for you and when you feel ready. And for me, I had the instinct of doing it in a car. And then I realized that sounded dangerous. So I waited until we got home. And I said, Mum,
So you're basically saying don't come out in the car.
I mean, you can, but just be aware that if someone's driving and it is a shock, that may not be the best idea. But, you know, come out when you're ready and when you feel able. And I got home and I sat Mum down and I said, I have something to tell you. And she said, what? And I went, I'm not straight. No, I said, actually, the actual story is I said, Mum, I've got something to tell you. And then she went, what, do I smell? Which was like a very unexpected and very bizarre moment. And I was like, no, I'm not straight. And then I said, can you not tell Dad? And then Dad walked in the door. And that was that conversation. Because my parents, you know, my parents together, they live together, blah, blah, blah. But I didn't know how my dad would react. He was a lot older. And I was nervous. I'd had friends who'd been disowned. I'd had friends who'd been told, don't spread it to the rest of the family. Don't feel that. Can I pay you not to feel this way? I'd had friends with those experiences. And so I was very anxious. And I think my mum had known. And I think she said a few hurtful things when I was younger to try and persuade me not to be. Not intentionally. She thought she was being subtle. She was not. And she's apologized for that since, because my mother is an incredible human. But then she held that secret. She held that secret from Dad. Until I felt ready to come out to him. And I waited. And then I told him and I said, Dad, I'm not straight. And he went, that's silly. And I went, why? And he went, I think you'd be a really good mum. And then that's like when the activist me comes out and I'm like, oh, but look, this is all the different ways. And like marriage and civil partnership and adoption and surrogacy and like pregnant. I would like to be a mum. And he did take it a bit harder. I think for both of them have been through their own things in their own lives to realize that I was the same person the minute before I told them to the minute after, and that I was, for the things that were important to them in terms of, you know, doing well in school, doing well at university, whatever, that, you know, they were their kind of values, I was still doing that. And actually, for a lot of LGBT plus people, that stuff suffers when they can't be themselves. Right? When you think about like work placement and why people are talking about authenticity, the reason that like really big capitalist banks are talking about this and doing stuff is because actually they know that if someone can put the picture of their husband or wife or partner or whatever on their table in the same way that anyone else can, they will do better at work. And they'll do better at work because they're not having to lie and protect and think of the backstory that they told. And so my parents, from that perspective, were great. And then I ended up getting involved in a summer camp in America. And actually, I was also involved in a summer camp here for 2 years.
Oh, which one in America?
The URJ Camp Kalsman. Okay. It's just north of Seattle, Washington. And it was the first place I'd really met LGBT plus Jews, LGBT plus rabbis and lay leadership, and found a Jewish space where I could be myself and found a space where I could pray and I could engage in Judaism and I could have fun and I could climb the tower that they have and I could, you know, do all the fun, you know, summer camp things and exist. And it was such a wonderful and beautiful moment. And honestly, I think summer camp is the reason I'm engaged in Judaism still and still love it, because I found that space. And there is a lot of kind of individualism in Judaism, but it is the community that I really love. And it's I find it sad that I had to go to America to find that. And I'm finding it still here. It's still, I still don't really feel like I have a set community, but I definitely have individuals and friends and people that kind of hold that space for me and with me. But that's kind of like my coming out story, I guess. And, you know, I told my brother as well, and he was fine with it. I guess it, in some ways he's less of the narrative, although actually he's really important. I had a conversation with him right before I came out to my dad, and he was like, actually, you're not giving dad enough credit. You know, my brother was the person to say that, being like, you need to give dad more credit. And sometimes that's the thing. The fear can be so great inside you when you feel like you could get kicked out, when you feel like you might feel that rejection. It can be bigger than it is. And for some people, it is. It ends up being that bad.
Yeah,
and
for some people, you don't know, right?
Yeah, and some people doesn't. And that's the thing. That idea of not knowing. So when we're talking at Keshet UK about, you know, to our schools and to our synagogues and our communal organizations, don't assume that LGBT people know you're great, or that you did that session 3 years ago or 2 weeks ago or yesterday. Right. Make it really clear what your position is. Make it clear in the pictures you're having, and make it clear in terms of the statements on your websites. You know, if you're a school, make sure you have explicit policies that say homophobic, biphobic, transphobic bullying is not acceptable here, in the same way that you would talk about racism or sexism or disabled. You know, make it really explicit, because if you are generic, bullying is bad. Okay, cool. That actually means if a young person experiences something and they've had a bad experience with a teacher potentially, or they've had a bad experience in a separate community that feels a bit similar at school, they may not know that this community is actually going to help them when they're being discriminated against. And I think that explicit thing, and that's the same for parents actually, you know, you can do things that can help signal to your children that if they were to come out, that's okay. You don't have to make it really explicit. You don't suddenly have to wear a pride flag. It's not about that. It's about the way in which you talk to people and making sure you are trying to be inclusive. So if people are being complacent, ask them about, well, what kind of stuff do you do to be trans inclusive? How is the language you use inclusive to LGBT plus people?
What I'm curious about, when I was at university, about a decade ago, there was this thing about having a toilet for trans people, right? Mm-hmm. And they had this motion, it went for, and it didn't pass. It got rejected.
Okay.
Because the idea, you know, is saying we want to have a toilet called like the non-gender toilet. Mm-hmm. And I happen to be good mates with the chair of the LGBTQ, I think, the society. And I said, why do you care that people share your beliefs, in terms of all you want is a toilet that trans people can use? So why not just have a toilet that just says on it, toilet? There's no man, there's no woman, it just says on it, toilet. And he reflected, put the motion in again, just to say, we want a toilet called toilet. And it passed overwhelmingly. And so when it comes to the language that we use, one, does it matter if everyone is on side? Or is the action more important?
The answer, like many things, is both of those things are important. I think people do things for lots of different reasons. Lots of people have different levers, right? I think I'm quite lucky in the fact that most people I work with, their genuine reason for doing things is they want to support and be kinder to LGBT plus people. But I mean, other levers can be that you've seen, you know, you rejected one LGBT plus person, and then you saw their aunt, uncle, grandparents, like actual parents, cousins, friends, the gardener, everyone else leave the community. That's one lever. Another lever for schools might be Ofsted and that compliance and like making sure that they're being more compliant. There are lots of different reasons why people do things. One could just be they want to be seen to be a bit nicer. They don't actually really care, but actually they want to try and do something. But often if you start doing something, you start to realize why that's important. If you're doing things tokenistically, other problems will arise. You know, changing a policy but not actually implementing it, you're not actually going to see a safer place. So from that perspective,
could you give me an example of what you might mean in terms of the difference between something that might be tokenistic and actually a real effect policy?
So if you were to put a sign on a window that says this is an LGBT plus safe place, great. As an LGBT plus person, that's actually really nice because it means I can walk into that space. However, if you have not trained your staff, if you have not considered what your forms look like when you're talking about, instead of saying, you know, mothers and fathers, you say parents and guardians or whatever it might be. If you've not considered your policies and your procedures and the training and the language you're using and the facilities that you're doing and the sessions that you're running, that nice sticker on the outside is actually going to be putting people into harm, and it's completely tokenistic. Like, it's nice you feel confident enough to say that. It's nice that you're not worried about the backlash, but actually, it's entirely tokenistic. it's not actually helpful. And so in terms of the toilet, the kind of thing,
it's an interesting issue, right?
Well, it's one of those things that people kind of think it's really funny because you spend so much time talking about toilets. But actually,
I don't think it was funny. I think it was interesting.
No. Well, I mean, yeah. So interesting. But I think a lot of people kind of they laugh when I tell them how much of the time I can spend talking about toilets. But it comes with a level of privilege to be able to walk into a space and be 100% comfortable. If you're a very masculine looking woman, you can have a really awful experience in a toilet. And if you're a trans woman, you can also have a really awful experience in a toilet because people are looking at you and thinking, should you be here? They're not looking at their behaviors. They're not seeing if you ran in there chasing after someone being, you know, aggressive, which is, you know, that's like bad. Obviously, if you were to see a man running in after someone into a toilet, you know, you should do something about that behavior. If you see someone casually walking into a toilet, it's still an area and a space that's policed. I was at back to the wedding. Oh, this happens outside of wedding spaces. And I walked in and, I'm wearing a suit. And someone goes to me, oh, I'm sorry. I think you've taken a wrong turn. And I went, oh, no, I haven't. It's okay. And she went, oh, yes, I can tell by your voice, but not by your chest. That's a really weird thing to say to someone. Like, it's a weird thing to, like, be policing that space when all I'm trying to do is go to the toilet. But it's also a very strange thing to think. And it's weird how much people think that would never happen or they would never do that. But actually, it sounds like
a reflex, though, right?
Yeah, because people police these spaces. And so there's a few things. Number one, having toilets that just say toilet or gender-neutral toilet or this is a toilet with a urinal, this is a toilet with, you know, stalls. They make it safer for lots of people, not just trans people or gender non-conforming people, but, like, a lot of people feel safer. People feel more able to go to the toilet and not be more worried. But then also, I think there is a space sometimes for gendered spaces. I understand why a gendered space, why a women's toilet, whatever, or like even like, you know, like women's groups and things like that, and men's groups and other groups are important and can be important in terms of how they feel safe, how conversation can be different. But actually, if someone is going to cause harm, whether they be a man, a woman, someone who's non-binary, whatever age, they will find a way to cause harm. And I think the important thing that we need to do when it comes to safeguarding of our young people and safeguarding of all of our spaces and adults is really understand that, like, policing behavior is different to policing identities. If you see someone running in after someone to a changing room or something like that, that is probably an issue. If someone is walking into a toilet, if someone's walking into a changing room, if someone's going to sit down in synagogue, really think about what you policing that space will do and the impact on that space if you do police it and the impact on that individual. Because it's not always very fun to be told that you don't belong. It's not a nice experience to walk into a toilet and get stared at, right? You don't need to be policing that space. If you see someone doing something that is harmful, then we need to deal with that, you know? And that's kind of, it goes back to the media, that they're using these examples of, there's one example in the media right now of a trans woman who attacked people in prison. Loads of cis women attack women in prison and they have policies and procedures because actually if there is an awful trans woman, they should be dealt with like any other woman when they are doing horrific things in any space, right? And you ignore that and then suddenly that gets completely, you know, escalated and then suddenly all trans women might be these predators or all trans men might be these predators and it's actually, no, what you're doing there is transphobic. What you're doing is fear-mongering. It's the same stuff that happened in the kind of the 80s around...
Focus on the exception rather than the rule, right?
Yeah, and it's also just creating these ideas that then create very legitimate fear, right? So it's not, you know, it's still potentially transphobic, but it's a very legitimate fear of like, well, actually, am I safe? Is this space going to be okay? As a cis woman, am I being put in danger? And they're seeing these respectable people saying these things and like you're creating this fear and it's very legitimate fear. And it's about having these conversations and it's about making people understand. And so kind of back to your question a while ago, you know, what do you do when you're having a conversation with someone who thinks they know everything or who thinks they're right? A lot of the time it's about explaining these experiences and having people really understand that just because something is your experience doesn't mean it's someone else's experience and doesn't mean that if we were changing how you have a form, that your entire community is changing. And it's about having that really good understanding that the privilege that you may have, that invisible backpack, someone called Peggy McIntosh came up with this term privilege, which is like this invisible backpack that has like maps in it and a towel and food and money and all this stuff. And the best and worst thing about privilege is you don't even know you have it. That going back to that idea of if I went into a barbershop or, you know, when you get plasters and they say a skin color and actually they're kind of whitey peachish, right? That's not the same as a person of color. Or, you know, when you're in a session at Lamud and someone doesn't use a microphone and you think just being loud is good enough. But actually, if you're hard of hearing, a microphone makes that room accessible. That's a privilege to think, oh, just being loud will make it okay. Mm. It's about having that understanding and having those conversations, and in a way that aren't judgmental. People don't know stuff, and that's okay. Like, everyone has to learn things. Everyone has to make mistakes. And I think it's about how you have those conversations and how you create that space to ask those questions. And knowing that asking me, Dahlia Fleming, executive director of Kesha UK, whose job it is to do that, is perfectly fine. Asking that other random LGBT plus Jewish person may not be the okay thing. They shouldn't have to be doing the educating, right? Mm. Knowing that, like, that form of allyship, it's a process and it's hard, and it involves you Googling and being okay being told when you're wrong and doing all of that work. But if you care about these communities who aren't always included, whether they be the disabled community, the LGBT plus community, the people of like Jews of color, whatever it might be, it's up to you to do some of that work. And Kesha UK is to help there, to help enable them, to mean that other LGBT plus people don't have to be standing up at the front of a room if they don't want to be.
Dahlia Fleming, this has been great. Thank you so much for your time. As I said, I'm going to do everything I can to make sure these voices are heard. And also, I want to make sure that everyone's voice, to a certain extent, is heard, because I feel like in the conversation, it's where the interesting things come out, and hopefully we'll bring everyone along for the ride.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
So that was Dahlia Fleming from Keshet. Tune in next week when we have Rabbi Mike Moskowitz, an Orthodox rabbi who advocates for trans rights. Until then, like, share, do all that stuff, visit bagelpodcast.com, and thanks for listening.